Namaham Vishnu Vinaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Iti Namani Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Acharani Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Vaskacha Desitari. So today we will be reading from the third canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 31, text 44. Is that correct? 44, yes.
Jivo yasyanukat jivo yasyanugodeho
jivo yasyanugodeho
bhutendriya mahatmano maya
bhutendriya mano maya
tannirodhosya maranam
tannirodhosya maranam
Avibhavastu sambhava
Avibhavastu sambhava
Jivo hyanu gano deho
Jivo hyanu gano deho
Bhutendriya mano maya
Bhutendriya mano maya
Tannirodhosya mananam
Tannirodhosya mananam
Arvibhavastu sambhavaha
Arvibhavastu sambhavaha
Jivo hyasyam yan yugo deho
Jivo hyasyam yugo deho
Bhutendriya mano mayam
Bhutendriya mano mayam
Tannirodhosya maranam
Tannirodhosya maranam
Arvibhavastu sambhavaha
Arvibhavastu sambhavaha
Jiva
Jiva
The living entity
Living entity
He
He
Certainly
Certainly
I beg your pardon Indeed
Indeed
Asya
Asya
Of him
Of him
Anuga
Anuga
Suitable
Suitable
Deha
Deha
Body
Body
Bhuta
Bhuta,
gross material elements.
Gross material elements.
Indriya.
Indriya.
Senses.
Senses.
Mana.
Mana.
Mind.
Mind.
Mayaha.
Mayaha.
Made of.
Made of.
Tat.
Tat.
Of the body.
Of the body.
Nirodha.
Nirodha.
Destruction.
Destruction.
Asya.
Asya.
Of the living entity.
Of the living entity.
Maranam.
Maranam.
Death.
Death.
Avibhavata.
Avibhavata.
Manifestation.
Manifestation.
To.
To.
But.
But.
Sambhava.
Sambhava.
Birth.
Birth.
Translation. In this way, the living entity gets a suitable body with a material mind and senses, according to his fruitive activities. When the reaction of his particular activity comes to an end, that end is called death. And when a particular type of reaction begins, that beginning is called birth. Please repeat. In this way,
in this way
the living entity gets a suitable body,
with a material mind and senses,
according to his fruitive activities.
According to his fruitive activities.
When the reaction of his particular activity, comes to an end, that end is called death.
That end is called death.
And when a particular type of reaction begins, that beginning is called birth.
That beginning is called birth.
So let me read the two verses together because this particular verse starts with in this way. So the previous verse states, due to his particular type of body, a materialistic living entity wanders from one planet to another, following fruitive activities. And in this way, he involves himself in fruitive activities and enjoys the result incessantly. Then, in this way, the living entity gets a suitable body with a material mind and senses according to his fruitive activities. And when the reactions of his particular activity comes to an end, that end is called death. And when a particular type of reaction begins, that beginning is called birth. So Srila Prabhupada and our previous acharyas will speak on this verse. From time immemorial, how long is time immemorial?
Forever.
Almost, yes. Time immemorial means like forever. For as far back as anybody could ever trace, from time immemorial. So this applies to us. We should listen to this carefully, because sometimes, as devotees, we feel like I'm already a devotee. I know all of this. I've heard it so many times in the classes. I know this. I need something new. But actually, when we listen to this with new ears, instead of new message, but new ears, we get all kinds of insights that we had not had before. So listen to this very carefully. Think, this is Srila Prabhupada telling you about your life. From time immemorial, the living entity travels in the different species of life and the different planets almost perpetually. Now think about that for a moment. I'm a living entity. I have been traveling almost perpetually in different species of life. I've experienced being a dog, I've forgotten it. I've experienced being a cat, I've experienced being a rat, I've been a snake, I've been a whale in the ocean, I've been a porpoise jumping around, I've been a germ, I've forgotten it. It all seems now like some fantastic. This is too hard to believe. I can't believe this. I'm here, I'm solid. I'm an Indian, or I'm an Australian, and I'm such and such an age, and I have such and such a family, and have such and such a job, and I think such and such a way. How can I believe this? The materialistic mind actually blocks this out, this kind of knowledge, because we're absorbed right now in our own new universe. And the universe exists within our head. It's not a universe that everybody enters in. Everybody here plays a part in my universe. So-and-so is sitting there. Somebody is sitting over there. There's a boy sitting here. There's somebody sitting there. I'm seeing it all. They're all part of my universe. And so the scientists today are trying to break down this, but with an atheistic intention. They talk in physics that it just appears there because you think it's there, you're desiring it to be there. It actually has no substantial reality. And in so many ways, through so many formulas and mathematics, they try to produce in you an understanding. This is actually an illusion, which is actually a gift if we take it in the right way. They're actually working on our side if we take it in the right way. But the right way means that we don't accept their understanding that there is no creator, no mastermind, no personality who has made this mysterious, illusory place where now I think I'm a woman and you all think you're men and you think you're women and he thinks he's a little boy, and we're fixed in that. And here the Bhagavatam is saying, you have been doing this for such a long time, almost perpetually. You just keep doing it, going round and round. Another birth, I'm it. Another birth, I'm this. I've been this nation in this country. This has been my Bharatma. And then I'm born in Germany. And then I'm born in Russia. And then I'm born in China. and I take on the whole culture, and I take on what my parents take on, and I believe it, and I lead my life like that. And sometimes, if I'm especially intelligent and curious, what I do is I go back over my family tree. There's a website. Genealogy.com. I'm not giving an advertisement. Because you press in there and you put a few details, and all of a sudden, you're going to hear about all these people that they say you're related to. And that's going to intensify the sense that this is me, and that was my mother, my grandmother, my great-grandmother was this, my great-great-great-grandmother was this, and we all came in a line. Some people will say, we are Jews. Jews means Yadavas, Jew, Yadu. So we are the chosen people. We are actually coming right back from Lord Krishna. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But everything they're saying, it may be correct, it may be not correct, but it all pertains to my situation right now. Here's my situation, and it has a long tail. But here, Krishna is saying your situation right now is totally ephemeral. So take the tail and your situation and understand that it's a temporary moment in eternal time. It's a temporary moment in eternal time. And that's somewhat comforting when the moment that we're in right now is torturous. When something very bitter is happening to us. When some difficulty we are facing, some stress is there. We're happy to hear that this is just a moment in time. Oh, thank you. It will pass. But as soon as we get over the difficulty, we start running again like a rat with a long tail. On again with our course, with our self-designated course. And what that means is instead of becoming part of this long genealogical trail, depending on what I'm thinking at the time when I leave this world, what desire is most prominent, I can go into a whole other family or ancestry or something over here, and I take all that on. And I believe it. It's absolute truth to me. This is who I am. So as devotees, we will read on here, but we should ask ourselves, is there any way out? Is there any way out of this perpetual cycle of desire, receiving, good, bad, sifting away the bad, trying to increase the good? This morning I was listening to Srila Prabhupada and he said, everyone is faced with a certain destiny. And within that destiny there are good things, by their understanding, and there are bad things. And their whole business in meditation is to remove the bad things, to reduce the bad things, to equalize, neutralize the bad things, and to amplify and increase the things that are good. And this is what they will do as they struggle for existence. This is what everyone is doing. So everyone includes us, even though we're devotees, so we're very fortunate because we have in our hand the key of knowledge. But I might have the key to somebody's house, but I might not know where the house is. So I've got the key, this is wonderful, but I don't know where the house is. So we have to know this is the key. This is the key to what? It's the key to unlocking this perpetual cycle of going round and round and round like an endless taxi ride. Through forever, round and round and round the wheels go. And round and round and round we go. And every time we believe it, fully, 100%, is there any way to escape this? The word that Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur liked to use, and it's not a commonly used word, was thraldom. It's almost like a Shakespearean word. It sort of means like a horrible sense, but it means you're totally enthralled in something, and it's totally engulfing you, and it's totally your reality. And it's good and bad and everything else. It's all you're thinking about. You're enthralled by it. Is there a place I can use this key of knowledge and somehow or other at least step out a little bit from this binding thraldom and actually experience that there is truth in what is being said here? This is not just our religious books because we're part of a certain group. We were born in a country, we came across this. Srila Prabhupada emphasized, he sat here and he emphasized with such gravity. He had a very kindly, smiling face also, but when he spoke on the Vyasasam, when he put those glasses on, he spoke with gravity and weight of the absolute truth. This, he was saying, is the truth. And without the slightest trace of arrogance or pride, he would be saying, and everything you're all thinking, including myself, is complete ignorance. By not saying that, he would say that sometimes, but he didn't fight us to take away our ignorance because we're very attached to it. But by his presentation, this is the truth, it automatically challenged our worldview. And sometimes it was really uncomfortable to be challenged like that. And I remember sometimes coming into a class here, I used to sit over here, and he would speak here, and his secretary and his assistants would sit right there. And Madhavisa Prabhu, who was in charge of the temple at that time, he would stand up there, and he had a big strong chest. And he looked really pleased with himself because he was on the side of truth. And I would come in because I was a little doubtful, had little doubts in my mind running around like little ants. And I'd come in, I'd look at him, and I didn't want to look at him because he looked very confident. And I would scruffle across here and sit down, and I'd go, oh no, we're going to have another dose of this. Because again, Srila Prabhupada was going to speak the truth, the truth, the truth. And he was unyielding. Unyielding when he sat on the Vyasasan. He was teaching us the truth. This is the truth. This is not my understanding. This is not my idea. This is not a Hinduism. This is not anything other than the truth. So now, years later, I ask myself sometimes, when are you going to grow up? When are you going to have some kind of a strong, steady understanding that doesn't go like this and like this and like this with the world's ways? When are you going to be able to recognize this is the truth? And then, even more bigger question that we should ask ourselves, when are we going to start, oh, I've started, but slowly, when am I going to start realigning my vision of reality to fit this? When am I going to do that? And the only thing I can sort of, I look a little sheepishly in the direction of Srila Prabhupada and remember his gravity. And if you want to have an experience of it, then look at the videos that were taken here in Melbourne. It's a wonderful thing to do, to look at those videos and see what he carries, the stature that he carries in his face and his presentation. And look at the people who are there. They're all little kids. They look younger than these young boys. Of course, we were all in our 20s, early 20s. And here we were faced with this absolute truth. And of course, we're like, but what about all the things I want to do? And what about this and this and this and this? And he was very strongly rearranging. When we were in his presence, he was rearranging by his conviction our vision of what was actually significant and insignificant. But the difficulty was, as soon as we walked out the door, we rearranged it back. No, that's more important than that. And we were very good at relativizing everything, as everyone is, because we were sort of like, oh, well, I have to fit between the truth and the world, So I have to just adjust a little bit, and then we'd go zip, and we go back into our worldly way of thinking. Worldly way means here I am, this is me, this is my family, this is my responsibility, this is my, and I here, am here in the center of my sense of reality. And then again, come the next morning, creep into the temple room. Some people didn't, they walked in very powerfully because they had some understanding and acceptance. But I remember being as a householder, go home to the family, come back to hear Srila Prabhupada again, speaking in the same way. And when he came off the Vyasasan, when you met him in person, he was somewhat different. Because then he would be talking to you and he would be trying to think how to direct you as the individual who's sitting in front of him, with all your problems in mind and all your questions and doubts, how to direct you further forward to a state of mind where you could accept that this was the truth. So he would make personal adjustments, because we all come with our own tale. Tale, T-A-L-E, our own story. And tale, T-A-I-L, I'm the son of this person who's the mother of this person who was related to that person and that person, and we have a long tale. And here we are, and then he's trying to just gently give us, why don't you move a little this way? That'll be good for you. And then you had to follow it. You had to become mature gradually enough to follow the directions, the little adjustments that he was making, and trust them that they were little adjustments towards this truth. And here is the truth. From time immemorial, the living entities travels in the different species of life and the different planets almost perpetually. This process is explained in Bhagavad Gita. Brahmayan sarva bhutani yantra rudrani mayaya. Under the spell of Maya, everyone is wandering through the universe on the carriage of the body offered by the material energy. Do we see it? I think we'd have to, almost all of us would have to almost obviously admit, I don't see like that. I remember one time we were studying in Perth. It was in the late 90s, and my husband was just beginning a comprehensive study of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And he wanted that people would commit themselves to a six-month course, and they would study 4 hours a day. Now, how many people can do that? There's one. Very good. You deserve it. But most people started it out. They started with this commitment. We had a big inauguration, and it was in our house at that time. And I think about 15 people, 12 people, not the whole temple, obviously, because people have jobs and so on. But a group of people started it, and then after 1 month there was significantly less, and after 2 months there was significantly less, and I think we ended up with about 5 or 6 people who were doing it. And so, of course, I had to set the example. So I had my desk, and we had all these notes that we had to do. We had to read a section, maybe 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 verses, and then we had a discipline we had to follow to actually say, what was that about? And you had to make it, summarize it into a sentence or so. And then you had to write certain, there were certain criteria. And I remember we were working on the third canto when it occurred. And I'm sitting there at my desk, and outside is the world. And we're speaking about the creation and the process of creation and how, first of all, this is created and then that's created. And it was quite easy to summarize, because anyone can summarize some text, like any scholar, so you can summarize that, that was okay. And then you had to, at some point you had to write something that came somewhat from your understanding. And I remember as I was summarizing, that was okay, that was okay. Then I got to this point where I had to assimilate this extraordinary knowledge of the beginning of creation of everything into my reality. And I remember vividly looking out the window, and I could see cars going by and trees and houses and the normal things you see on the street. And I remember writing it down on my paper, because the papers were never given to anyone. You had just had to do it by yourself. And I'm saying, I don't see earth, water, fire, air and all these things. I don't see senses and this and that, minds and intelligence. I see trees, cars, houses. How do I integrate what I'm seeing with what the Bhagavatam is speaking about? It's so vast. It's so remote to me. How do I integrate those two things? And then I sat for a long time looking at that, because it wasn't what I was supposed to write, but it was like I had to say it, because it was bursting out. I'm not seeing this. This seems theoretical. It seems far away. Not real. And then I had to sit down with myself and actually go through, okay, so you see houses, you see this, you see that. Where did they come from? And I had to go backwards. And the mind was a little unwilling, because we say, okay, we go backwards. We go back to the history. We go back to when Australia, there were only Aborigines. Then we go back to this. We can only go a very short way back. Even if we go back millions of years, trillions of years, even if the scientists tell us there was an ice age or we were all apes before, they don't take us back millenniums. They only take us back a certain way. And all the way back, they're still dealing with the same thing. People, things, vehicles, food. The same things are going on all the time. Where did it come from? And then when you hear scientific explanations, particularly explanations that indicate that it somehow or other came from a random source, it's very, very, very hard to believe it. Because as far as back as everyone's talking, there was some sense of order. So then I re-looked at the Bhagavatam and I see, okay, so here we're talking about something so vast, it's outside of our comprehensive power. It's outside of our experience. It's outside of the experience of the greatest minded atheistic scientist, or physicist, or academic. It's way outside their mind. If you were to listen to what they say in their classes, you'd see, no, you're nowhere. You're just talking about a little view of reality. And Srila Prabhupada said, the scientists, and he was not speaking academically here, but he said, the scientists, I think it includes us, he said, it's like somebody sitting looking out of a window, and a horse gallops by. So when the horse gallops by the window, you see it, right? Anyone can relate to this analogy. But where it came from and where it's going, you cannot see. You're conditioned, you're restrained, you can only see this. So the scientists analyze everything about the window and the horse that ran by, what speed he ran by, and it could be that because he ran by at that speed, we can calculate by these figures he could have been that far away when he started running. They can do a lot of things, but it's kind of meaningless. If you could go outside and watch the horse and see, oh, he came from Mr. Jones's paddock and he's gone up here, you could give a more accurate information than from their scientific analysis. Although their scientific brains are brilliant, they're given by God. They didn't just randomly come. This is how we have to learn to see. We have to learn to see Krishna's hand in everything. Integrate your spiritual understanding and ask the doubtful questions. But ask the doubtful questions with a faithful mind. In the Vedic culture, a student of any great teacher, there were different parts of his learning. And one of them was to hear so many things and to assimilate them without saying anything. He didn't argue then. But one part of the learning process was to present as many doubts as you could. So I read about this, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentions this, and at the time I thought, that would be really difficult, because then you would get all doubtful again. But then I understood from what he was saying that you don't introduce these doubts to become doubtful. You may already still be doubtful. So you introduce your doubts, and then you introduce them to the process of learning in a submissive way. That can you please relieve me of these doubts? This is my understanding. And this was why at the end of every class that Srila Prabhupada gave, he would ask, are there any questions? And, you know, we'd sit there and I used to find that I had questions as he was going along, but by the end I lost them. I couldn't listen to him and retain my questions. Or I knew that he was going to redefine my doubts. And I was quite fond of my doubts. They justified why I behaved in a certain way. And he was not going to accept that. He was going to tell me very, very strongly what is the truth. And one time I was in Hawaii with many doubts. It was a doubtful period of my life. I had a good crop of doubts. And I was sitting there in the temple room, and he was speaking, and all of a sudden, it was the same gravity. He said, if you are not going to accept what the spiritual master says, then don't ask any questions. And I was like, oh no, I'm doomed. Because I knew I'm not going to be able to accept, because I have so many doubts. I have baskets and baskets of them. And he's going to say something simple, and I'm going to think, oh, that doesn't explain everything. What about this? What about this? What about this? And on and on and on. So now I can't ask. So now I'm stuck with all my doubts. But then I began to realize what he was saying was referring to the mindset in which you should ask. Not that don't ask any questions unless you believe what I say. That was not what he was saying. But he was saying your mentality, don't ask until your mentality is one of wishing to clarify your doubts. Don't waste time, your time and my time. Because I think we all know as children, if not as adults, we've done that sometimes with our parents. I want to go out. And my father says, no, you should stay inside right now. So I am doubtful about that. I want to go out. So then I say, but can I do this? No, you should stay inside right now. But it needs this need. And all these doubts are coming up. Not doubts. It's a simple thing. I want to go outside. And you're saying stay here. So I've created a whole range of doubts that maybe if you can't satisfy them, if I push them on you hard enough, my father was a very gentle person, so if I pushed hard enough, oh, but I want to please, and why about this, what about this, and talk too much, he'll say, okay, go out. So Krishna is like that too. Krishna is like that too. So this is why we transmigrate, because we say, I want it, take it. First he says, don't take it. It's not good for you. It won't help you at all. We say, no. If I don't have this, I think I'm probably going to suffocate and die. All right, go. But Krishna is so merciful. Not only does he say that, but he says, okay, go. And he says, and I'll go with you. I'll go with you in case you need my help to turn around your misadventure and accept my shelter again. I'll go with you. So Prabhupada says, look at this quality of relationship. Look what Krishna is handing us, offering us, in lieu of our preconceived universe in the head. He's saying, I'll take care of everything. Do you have any problems? I'll take care of them. Trust me. Surrender to me. And surrender not meaning like this, as we talked about, if you don't surrender, I'll shoot you in the head. It's not that. It's if you don't surrender to what I'm instructing you, you will be lost. And if you ever go somewhere in your car and you get lost, you have no a computer, calculator, phone with you, nothing, and you're lost, You know, it's not a nice feeling to be lost, particularly in Delhi. Because in Delhi, all the numbers mean nothing. All the suburbs mean nothing. You go down here and it's B block, and then over here is A block, and then this one over here is X block, and it's just, you're lost. And you need someone, right? Ajahn Sukha? Yes, you would, GPS meaningless. Because there's no order. There's no logic like here. And of course, in Melbourne, everything's logical and done in a perfect manner. But there, people, it evolves gradually and it has its own life. So we're lost. If we felt lost, we would be very grateful that we have a companion who can guide us. We would feel the relief. But because we don't feel lost, when the Bhagavatam tells us, you know you're lost, we feel that it's a sort of we feel uncomfortable with that. I'm not lost. I'm a quite competent person. But in reality, from the absolute perspective, from the spiritual perspective, we're quite lost. We can say, we're not lost, we're devotees, the people out there are lost. But we're not lost. But many's the time I look at myself and I say to myself, I think you're quite lost right now, aren't you? And I'm, yes. And I have to again go back to this absolute truth, this rock solid principles of how everything works. So under the spell of Maya, everyone is wandering throughout the universe on the carriage of the body offered by the material energy. Materialistic life, this is what we're observing, materialistic life involves a series of actions and reactions. It is like a long film spool of actions and reactions. Has anyone ever seen a spool of film and they pull it out? Yeah? So you know that it minutely, the movement is imperceivable almost. Like, if you have a spool of film, there's one picture, one picture, one picture, one picture, one picture, and in the first picture I'm doing this, and in the second picture I'm doing that, and the next picture I'm doing that, and the next picture I'm doing that. Imperceptible, just a tiny bit of movement is going on. And when you play that fast, it looks like, wow, she's really moving around and doing so many things. So now we're hearing about the spool, we're hearing about slow down your mind for a moment and your life and try to understand what it actually looks like from that perspective, from a higher perspective. When a child is born, it is to be understood that his particular type of body is the beginning of another set of activities. And when an old man dies, it is to be understood that one set of reactionary activities is finished. So some people think that because one set of reactionary activities are finished, and the body is finished, that the person has gone to heaven. That the person, in other words, the person is free now. This is now a case of freedom. But the Bhagavatam explains that you may not be free, because you may still have a big treasure house of things you wished for, wanted for, and would like to have continued doing. And so Krishna is so kind, he awards you another situation. So that is like a chapter of a book rather than a book. And now another chapter begins. And it's very bitter and painful, I think, for the vast majority of people in this world, although it's not so difficult for us, although it is difficult, to accept that my son, my daughter, my auntie, my uncle, when they pass away, they're sort of not my auntie or uncle or son or daughter somewhere else. It's very difficult to accept that. So therefore the concept of going to paradise or to heaven or somewhere, right up to some Christian conceptions that we will all go as a family, which is again even more tight, my whole family will go. And of course, each of these concepts, they're open to discussion. If we're so attached as a family, we've all been committed, we've committed our lives at the same time, we're going as a family, the question can be asked, if we're going as a family, my grandmother died 50 years ago, I'll die tomorrow, what time of the life of our family are we going to go? Is my grandmother really old? Is she young? Would she like to be when she was 20? When she was 20 she didn't have children, so I wasn't born, she wasn't married. Does her husband when she was 40 go? It's very confusing. And so a lot of people, they think, this is so confusing, if you think about it carefully, without just simple faith, it's so confusing, I think it's all made up. It's not really real. And I think to myself sometimes, how subtle and vast and intricate the material energy is, that it's seamless. It's so seamless that people don't even notice things happening. You don't notice yourself growing old, except in the mirror. You don't notice, even when somebody dies, life goes on, it goes on, it goes on. Someone dropped out, but life goes on. And they pop up again, and life goes on. It goes on. It's so vast, it's so superiorly designed, that we don't even think it's there, like air. But if we cut off the circulation of air, because we don't see air, so air may not be really such an important thing. If you cut off the circulation of air by cutting off somebody's breathing process, instantly they're finished. Because the air is there, and the air is so superior, and the scientists who can measure it in a different way will tell you, you can't see it, but the air is there. So similarly, you cannot see these laws of nature, but they're there. So another set of reactionary activities begin. A man is born in a rich family and another man is born in a poor family, although they're both born at the same time, in the same place, at the same moment, in the same atmosphere. They're born in the same hospital. Same time, wonderful occasion, terrible time, and they're born right next to each other in two different beds, and one of them is destined for a fortunate life and the other one is destined for some terrible struggle. One is carrying impious activities and is given a chance to take birth in a lower or a poorer family. And the change of bodies means a change to a different field of activities. Similarly, when the body of the boy changes into that of a youth, the boyish activities change into youthful activities. So I am staying with Sri Chaitanya Prabhu, and when I'm staying with Sri Chaitanya Prabhu, I stay in Dhruva's room. And it always fascinates me to see all of his certificates and his book taste and his awards at this age and that age, pictures of him as a little boy. He saved them, so they're all in one corner in a closet. And so when I look at them, I think to myself, oh yes, I used to do that. I used to think like that. But now I'm like bigger than that. And the books change. The first books are for little children, then for growing children, and then you start looking, and you're bored with that. And you're bored with that now. I've read that, done that already. So his activities are changing from childish activities, gradually changing to youthful activities. And the parents, I heard Srila Prabhupada say this, they don't cry. You don't see Sri Chaitanya Prabhu sitting here in front of the deities crying and crying and crying, and you ask him what's wrong, and he says, my son's babyhood has died. Babyhood has died? What? He's not a baby anymore. Maybe you do see some people like this, but not many. Because we accept that. That's natural. Of course, he's happy. Look, he's growing up. But so when someone dies, we're asked to see it in the same way. Another chapter has begun for them. But because we've trained ourselves by our thinking and lack of knowledge to be so fixed in reality, meaning this is me, and the world is reality. So when our family member dies, we feel great sadness because now they're no longer with us. And we want to know that, okay, my auntie is somewhere else, she's sitting up here in a wonderful place, she's happy, she's peaceful, and then they'll go to the lengths of someone saying, I have psychic powers and I can tell you that your auntie is smiling right now. or your auntie is sending you love, so don't worry. And they go, oh, thank you. But this is just perpetuating the same solid sense of unreality that we're accepting as reality. So we as devotees, of course, we don't do that, do we? A little bit. Similarly, when the body of the boy changes into youth, we accept it. It is clear that a particular body is given to the living entity for a particular type of activity. This process is going on perpetually from a time which is impossible to trace out. Vaishnava poets say, therefore, anadi karma phale, which means that these actions and reactions of one's activities cannot be traced, for they may even continue from the last millennium of Lord Brahma's birth to the next millennium. We have seen the example of this in the life of Narada Muni. In one millennium, he was the son of a maid servant, and in the next millennium, he became a great sage. So, in one part of our life, we may be a fool. And in another part of our life, in this journey, we also may become great sages or greatly wise by being able to, with our own hard work and our own sincerity and the association of many other persons who are trying to do the same thing, we may be able to subdue our doubtful nature, not smash it away, because it will still exist, but subdue it with the help of knowledge and application of that knowledge, so that we can open our consciousness more and more and more to the sunlight that comes from the transcendental aura of the transcendental supreme personality of Godhead. And this is what Srila Prabhupada came to benedict on anyone who was fortunate enough to touch anything to do with the Krishna consciousness movement. More or less, he was confident that it's just a matter of time. Anyone who has some acquaintance with Krishna consciousness, it's just a matter of time. You can choose how long if you want. You can be stubborn and say, I want to stay in this ignorant state. And Krishna will say, I'll go with you. Watching, waiting for a moment when you might comply to my direction. So let me finish with some nice quotes that I found in my habitual way related to this relationship. It's always been for me, personally in my Krishna consciousness, that an issue of trust. This Srila Prabhupada and, of course, devotees, do I trust them? But the core trust is, do I trust Krishna? Because they're representing him, so do I trust him? And trust and faith are similar. If you have faith in somebody, you'll do what they say. So I've always been alert to be checking, how is my trust doing? Is it coming stronger or is it sort of shaky? And if it's getting weaker for some reason, why? Is this something I'm doing that's not quite right? And oftentimes I've taken that as a form of prayer to in my own Krishna consciousness, like, please show me what it is that's really blocking me right now. And then please also help me to make my way through that blockage if possible. And Srila Prabhupada many times, along with being very firm about the principles and the reality of transcendence, he was also very encouraging that Krishna is going to help you if you do that. So this is something that I was reading. He said, the Supreme Lord is so kind and so friendly with us that he is also with us. So when I hear that, I think I have to apply that. I may make a mistake. I may do something stupid. I may say, if you're with me, could you help me get a new bicycle? If that's what I like, bicycles. But he might not give me a new bicycle because I want a new bicycle, but I'm developing a sense that he's with me, and that will further need refinement until I'm in the right mood of a servant. But at least to begin with, I have to have a sense that he's with me. Not only am I on his team, he's on my team. It's a relationship. Just imagine how much kind and friendly is the Lord. He is always trying to call me back to him. We are trying to non-cooperate with him. This is the reality. And he is trying to cooperate. He is sitting with me on the same branch. He is witnessing, observing, and waiting. Simply waiting. When shall I turn my face towards him? This is the whole thing. That's all. He is waiting. Just like a father and a rebelled or an insane child. Now it's quite profound that Srila Prabhupada uses this example, because from what I understand, which is not, I have no details on this, Srila Prabhupada himself had one of his children, I think there were four, and one of them also went insane. He had some mental disorder. So Srila Prabhupada is speaking himself also in this. So he says, just like a father and a rebelled or insane child, those who are elderly persons, they have got experience. If their sons go wrong, how much they are anxious. How much the father is anxious to get his son back again. That is natural instinct. And from where does it come? Where does this instinct come from? This instinct comes from the Supreme. Because everything in the material world is related to the Supreme. This is an amazingly wonderful way to think. It heals all the doubts and fears and everything. When you start to see, oh, everybody, Krishna's with everybody. He's not just with me and my friends here in the temple. He's with everybody. And he's not saying to those people out there, I'm indifferent to you, I'm neutral to you, I'm not, you know, I'll keep my mouth shut because you want to do so many stupid things. And when you get a book in your hand, I'll speak to you. He's not doing that. He's intensely personal with every living being at the same time. He can hear everybody's prayers at the same time. So I'm so busy worrying about my child who has become insane. How can I take care of my child? I cannot take care of a child if the child is insane. But it's my child, right? So I'm so much worried about my child. But when I understand that he's not my child, he's primarily not my child, primarily he's Krishna's child, and Krishna is traveling along with him, then instead of my trying to fix up the good fortune from the bad fortune of my child, I pray to Krishna that he's your child. Please help him. He's your child. You don't need me to ask you to help him. I know. But because he is in my attention, I have attention and affection for him, I'm praying on his behalf because he's not praying. Please protect him. Please protect him. And it's such a holistic way to have love and concern for others. Primarily they are Krishna's. Primarily Krishna is taking care. Secondarily I'm taking care. Please guide me how I should take care of your child. This is proper alignment. And remarkably, although it's unfamiliar with most of people of the world, it's a wonderful, thrilling way to look at things. It's a wonderful way. Because you become related to Krishna through your own prayers. In helping somebody else, you're cooperating with him. Cooperating. Now I'm trying to do it my way, myself, because this is mine. And I'm struggling. It's not so easy, and it's also illusory. So illusory things means I get it, poof, it's gone. I get this, it's gone. Like the babyhood, the boyhood, the youth, the old age, when were they mine? But they are eternally Krishna's. So Prabhupada says, we must always know that all these sentiments, this affection, this care, everything, they are coming from the Supreme. So if we study this material relationship between one living being and another, then a sober student, a philosophically minded student, can understand what is our relationship with God. It is not a difficult thing. So as we were saying yesterday, Srila Prabhupada said, it is our duty not to listen to anything unrelated to Krishna. And I spoke yesterday about how you should not be listening to things that are totally irrelevant to your Krishna consciousness, unnecessarily. But when you deal with the world, you'll have to do that, because it will be demanded of you. Then you must take the second approach, which is, this is an unrelated thing, I have to learn to see it as coming somehow or other from Krishna. I have to relate it to Krishna. The person who is telling me this peculiar piece of information, statistics, the world news, and so forth, he's seeing it one way, I have to see it another way. I want to be under the spiritual energy, not the material energy. And this is our duty and responsibility as devotees. And as we do this, as we practice this, as we learn it, we should share it with other people, because that's what will please Krishna more than anything. If we love and we're attached, imagine how much his concern is for those who do not have this awakened consciousness. So what can we do to help them come a little forward? If we take this mentality when we're dealing with the world, we won't be affected by the threats, the dangerous elements and so forth that are automatically part of material life, especially in this dark age of Kali. So please take the Bhagavatam as your friend and guide. Of course, also as a master and servant relationship. We don't want to be overly familiar, more informal than we should be. But at the same time, we want both. Yesterday I spoke to a lady, she was a Christian, and she was saying to me, when I grew up, I was given a concept of a God who was fearful. I grew up with lots of fears. There was the fear, don't go outside the church. If you go outside this church, you won't be saved, she said. And then one day I decided, I can't live with this God. She's not a philosophically trained person, but this was her line of thought. She said, I can't live with this God. I want a God who knows how many hairs there are on my head. So I understood what she was trying to say. She was trying to say, I want a God who I have a relationship with. I want a God who I have an intimate relationship with. He really cares for me. And I said it, but she couldn't always hear it. You already have that. That's everyone's heritage, to have that. Everyone already has that. And our real purpose in life is to try and remove some of the stuff between us and that God. But we, as Srila Prabhupada was very fond of saying, very proudly and happily he would say, but our God is the nicest God. He had a wonderful transcendental sense of humor. But yes, but Krishna is so wonderful. Too wonderful for most people to be able to accept initially. Too wonderful. We accept bitterness in the material world more easily than sweetness, because our hearts have a lot of bitterness still within. But please take seriously your life opportunity to be devotees in Krishna consciousness, and find out where your forte is, where you can fit in, and do the best you can with that, and grow, and take care of these children, because in this generation and coming generations, personalities will come here who have assignments here. We've come here because we have work to do. But some will come who have assignments, and they will do something of significance for the future of the world. So we try to... Also, one warning is, if you have children who excel in some way, don't spoil them. Don't tell them all the time. We did this to our own children. Prabhupada said, oh, the demigods are waiting in line. So we told our children all the time, oh, you're a little demigod, because we weren't so smart. And the children grew up spoiled. They had an ego problem because they thought, oh, I'm a demigod. I can do whatever I want because I... Mm-mm. So instead, Srila Prabhupada said, the teacher and the parent always sees the fault in training. No, this is not right. Do this. Correct this. Do this. Don't do that. The discipline has to be there. Otherwise, they become spoiled. This is if you're from the very beginning training them yourself. So this is just a thought. But so nice to be here. And thank you so much for your attentive listening. Hare Krishna. Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
You mentioned there is a difference between trust and faith.
Trust and faith.
Yes.
Trust and faith. Faith is, I mean, this is, I can't give you an absolute definition. Because Srila Prabhupada will use these words, Shraddha and so forth, in different ways. So I can't represent him in my definition. I mean, I won't attempt to do that. But for me, trust is kind of like a sense that if I can't do it, whatever it is, you won't abandon me. Because there's so much abandonment in the material world. Right? People are abandoning all sorts of things all the time. Bosses abandon their staff, people are abandoned easily. So there's a fear in the heart that if I'm little, I need to make myself as big and strong and fortified as I can so that you can't abandon me. I don't need you, I can make it by myself. And people, therefore, today also are very hard because I have to make it by myself. And trust is the opposite of that. I can put down my guard because you are not going to hurt me. And faith rests on trust. And faith, for me, this is my definition, faith is kind of like a confidence that when I feel like, uh-oh, I'm not sure if this is... I should trust this. I'm not sure if this is what I think it is. I hold on anyway till I get through it and look back and see if it builds my trust. Therefore, what happens is, say there's a difficult time, a difficult situation, to hold on, to keep your faith, you also need to be looking back and seeing, well, I've had difficult times in the past. For example, sometimes when I have to travel, because I don't give Bhagavatam classes on a regular basis, I wake up one morning and I'm not feeling very good, and I'll think, oh my gosh, I have to go to Melbourne. Oh no, and I'll have to give the Bhagavatam class, and I won't be able to remember anything. And I go through a whole, oh, this will be so hard for me. Then I have to say to myself, you should have faith in yourself, because you went last time, and it wasn't as bad as you think. You went a time before, and the trust is that Krishna will be there with me. And then the faith comes that then I think I'll be able to do it. And then when the situation occurs, you do it. Even if it's passing, going for an examination or anything, you do it. And then afterwards, you shouldn't only just say, that's over. But you should be thoughtful enough to say, I'll need to refer to that experience next time I'm in that situation where I absolutely don't feel like I can do something. I absolutely feel terrified about this situation. I have to be able to refer back and say, yes, but you felt like that before. And build your faith in yourself and in Krishna that somehow or other I'll get through this. Because a lot of times we live in the past and the present and not in the past and the future and not the present. So this is a good use of the past, to remember the times, and then to and trust means I'll do it anyway, even though I feel like I might be vanquished. I'll do it anyway because I've read this, I've read this, I've heard this. I've heard these things from the same source that tells me about transmigration, also tells me I have a companion. Also tells me there's a continuity. Also tells me that I have a relationship with everything. So you're not lost. So now let me make a step forward in that trust. Does that make sense? So the two things they like a husband and wife. One of them is more with the head, and the other is more with the confidence from the heart. Yeah. Good question. Any others?
Here we're talking about action and reaction.
Yes.
And it says beginning, birth, and end is the death.
Yes.
How do we understand? Because even in between, like after death and the next birth, we're still suffering in hellish life or something. There's that karma that's.
How do we understand?
How do we understand?
What? I don't understand you. What your question? Yes.
And the end is the death. But we also have this concept of karma death.
Yes. But the next episode, in the chat, if you read a book, you'll find that the story, some books, the story goes on, and the end of the chapter, it's almost the finish of the story. And the next chapter begins totally different. Like we're talking about Mr. Somebody there. And the last chapter was about somebody here. And sometimes what will happen is you end this story, but the start of the next one is the same character. Like Mr. Brown, the chapter finishes, he goes to sleep. And the next chapter finishes, Mr. Brown wakes up. So there's two different elements there. One is where something appears to be totally like disconnected, and the other is a strong continuity. And the more that a living entity is like heavily focused on something, heavily focused, like obsessive on something, the more that their next birth will take a continuity of that. Just like some countries have such an... I remember one time being in Bali, in Indonesia, and it's a beautiful place. It has, like any other place, it has so many problems, but it's scenically beautiful. And they have a Vedic culture, but it's not a Vedic... It's a Hindu culture, but it's not a Vedic Hindu culture. And enshrined in there is something to do with spirits and other things that's on the outskirts of Vedic Vaishnavism and far away from Vaishnavism. And so they really, really, really set... If they're born there, all these elements come into their life, and when they die there, they go through certain ritualistic procedures that more or less, without any interruptions from the outside, would definitely usually ensure them another birth there. Because there's so much pressure to be there, so much influence to be there. But now modern day, there's the internet, there's this, there's that. It's introducing all these different influences. So the same person might be born in Bali, and then when they're 12 years old, they come and live in Australia. And then at some time they want to see what India's like, they go to India. So they've got all these different influences. So at the time that they're going to leave this world, that kind of person may think, I want this, or I didn't get this. They can take a random action approach. And then, as far as I understand, those other threads sort of come as well, but you're a different person. Because people who have done, and it's not my field and neither am I interested in it particularly, but people who have done past life regressive type things, they'll often find that, oh, somebody in the family was born as this and somebody in the family was born as that. We have another set of relationships. So you may have some suffering that you're going on in one life. It may stop in the next life, may continue in the next life, but it will take a whole different shape because all the players change. They all move their seats around, you go and do it again. And if you're like so ingrained, no, this is the only thing I want, and this works both ways. If you're so ingrained that, no, the only thing I want is Krishna, take it all away, I don't want anything else, I want Krishna, then boom, like that, you're there. But most of
I say for myself, we have a variety of influences, a variety of things we're interested in, so we're partitioned in that way. So that creates fear and uncertainty in our mind sometimes. What's going to happen to me? Because I like this, and I like that over there, and I really have to have one of those in my life. So we spend a lot of time preoccupied and not really in a mood of service. That's a stage. It can last a little while or a long while, where we're more interested in what's going to happen to me. How am I going to get my needs met? And there's a lot of suffering in that, because even if you have a nice situation, you're always suffering because you're trying to set it up for you, and it's always shifting away because you're just one tiny little grain of sand. There was my husband one time was saying that if you could count all the grains of sand in all the beaches of the world, so first you should go down here to the Albert Park, have a walk along the beach, you know, put your hand in the sand, get a handful of sand, have a look at it, see if you can count them, and then if you could count all the grains of sand on all the beaches of the world, if the scientists could count all of this, still, they could not understand the unlimited qualities of Krishna. So then when we have that in our consciousness, the suffering is enormously reduced, even if we're in a difficult situation. And when we don't have that in our consciousness, we're like one of those little grains of sand, and you know, you can go like this and drop them all. So we feel the vulnerability, even though we want to be fortified, we feel very vulnerable. And within ignorance, we may blame that on God. That look, you've created all this suffering. But he's saying, no, look, understand it properly, there'll be no suffering. So this is what Srila Prabhupada is saying. Understand this. This is the truth. You'll be free of suffering. It will free you from suffering and allow you to serve the Lord. But we're struggling with that, and that's our suffering. So now you may be an Indian and you're struggling with that, and next life, who knows where, what, how, what type of karmic situation you have. But if you struggle and struggle and struggle to improve yourself in Krishna consciousness in this life, then Srila Prabhupada says your next life will be very auspicious. And he wants us to accept that. Your next life will be very auspicious. Because Krishna's watching you struggle. So he'll say, here, this is a much better place to go on with your developing your faith. And he will arrange that your next life is auspicious. So this is what we have to trust. That you say this, I've seen this happen to me in my life, that happened to me, I'm going to try and trust you. And do the best I can to move forward from wherever I am. But in ignorance, people, yes, they're born in one family. Srila Prabhupada went so far as to say, in the 1960s, when there was what was known as the Cold War between Russia and America, a Cold War means, a hot war means the bombs are dropping all around you, and a Cold War means threats all the time. They hate each other. You can have a cold relationship with somebody and they're always your enemy. So he said that someone is thinking their whole life, oh, the Russians, I hate the Russians. They're, you know, they're the worst people in the world. And he said, because of that constant meditation on the Russians, next life they're born as a Russian. So this is the intricacies of karma. So if we know these things, we can avoid ongoing suffering. But those who don't, those who have not come to this position yet, then they're learning through Krishna's guidance and perhaps they're suffering. We have to see like that, other than seeing that, oh, somehow God forgot about them. He's not kind to them. He's letting them suffer in so many ways. But if we come up to the higher knowledge, then we may have a chance to help someone who's suffering. Good question. Any other questions? Yes.
The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu, is very powerful.
Yes.
Then why does he need doorkeepers on his door?
Because, you see, anybody who's powerful, they have so many servants. They don't need them
because without them they can't manage them, their household, but they'll have a big house. And in that big house there'll be so many other people and so many things going on. So they have staff. You know what staff means? Staff means all the people who work for you. If you go into a shop, you'll see that there are people standing behind the counter and they'll say, "Can I help you? What do you need?" Yes? Have you seen that? In Coles? Yes. But that's not the person in charge of Coles doesn't do that. He's somewhere else having a good time. So he says, "They can do that and I will have a good time." So Krishna says, if you want to serve me, I have unlimited room for people to serve, and if you serve me, you'll have a good time. So those doorkeepers are very, very, very advanced devotees. And they're always thinking in this way, "Oh, I have to do my service to the Lord. He's so kind, he's given me this job, this opportunity to do this as a gatekeeper. Let me do it nicely." But the Lord, he doesn't need their service. But they need an opportunity to do it. What do you think about that? Yeah? One here?
Living entity,
yes.
He dies, he has all the desires he wanted.
Yes.
Then suddenly can he surrender and then go back home, or does he have to come back?
This is a really interesting question. I heard somebody talking to Srila Prabhupada and they asked him, "Is a living entity ever really lost, completely lost?" And Srila Prabhupada said, he answered, and then the person explained, "He's done so many horrible things in his life that Krishna just says, 'I'm sorry, you know, you can't come.'" And Srila Prabhupada was very firm and he said, "No, never. Nobody is ever lost. Because we are in nature and in heart and in existence, we're all pure. So we may be acting in horrible ways, but if you take all that horrible thing away, you'll come to a pure soul." So it's not that if I've acted horribly, I have to. And in fact, there's a wonderful question and answer session right here in Melbourne, where somebody asked Prabhupada this question. A young man asked, "Do I have to go through so many lives to get rid of all the horrible things I've done for so long and before I can fully surrender?" And Srila Prabhupada, if you've seen it, his eyes get big in that way. "No, in 1 second you can surrender. In 1 second. And Krishna will wipe everything clean. But that's in 1 second I can surrender. I can't in 1 second pretend to surrender and get that effect. Or say, 'I surrender this much, but behind here, don't touch this.' That means really say, 'Oh my gosh, please help me,' and Krishna will wipe it clean." So the answer is anyone at any time, even after a bad life, can surrender and Krishna will take care of everything. But like Ajamil, we read that story, that Leela, that Ajamil surrendered. He was assured by the Vishnu Dutas, "You are saved, you are going to Vaikuntha." And he was given some time to clean up his act. And he did that. So this was not a contradiction, but he was given some time. Just like if somebody says, "Please come now, you're going to meet the Queen of England." You might say, "Let me go home first and brush my hair and put on a different clothes, shave my face. You know, I have to be ready for this. This is a big occasion." So similarly, he was given some time and he cleared up all the misconceptions and the impious things by his devotional activities. This is what we are trying to do. We've been given some time. What is your doubtful question? We have so many doubts in a restless mind.
Is it a sign of that you have less faith?
Yeah, it's a sign of the immaturity of your faith. Just like, we don't have any here right now, but if you had a baby, say mother comes with a baby and puts the baby here on the ground, of course on a blanket, and then you come along and you say, "Stand up and walk." baby can't do it yet. But it's not that the baby will never do it, but it's a sign of the immaturity of the growth of the body of the baby. So a restless mind and many doubts is similarly the sign of the immaturity of your faith. That's not a bad thing. I'm not insulting you by saying that. But I look at myself like that too, rather than saying, you're so stupid, you know, why can't you get these things together? Why are you a fool? Or, I'm not sure if I believe any of these things. I think they might be this. And wandering away in a doubtful state, I try and tell myself, you know, you must be right now, you're acting sort of like a child. It's okay. It's not like, because the body is like this, but the mind can still be childish. Childish in relationship to the truth, not childish maybe as a person. But I'm a child in this knowledge. How long have you been chanting?
8 months.
8 months is a very short time. That's 8 months. So you're a very small child. But next time I come a year from now, I will look in your face and I will see many of those doubts have been resolved. Because you'll be going on chanting and you'll struggle. Because sometimes you have to struggle to get strong. You have to get... You watch a child trying to walk. You know, they have to up, down, fall over. But so if you look at yourself and think, in spiritual life I'm like a child, I'm trying to learn to walk, then you should be kind to yourself. But you should take the care of your parents or those around you who are trying to guide you. You don't want to be the kind of child that says, leave me alone. Don't tell me that. Don't tell me anything. But instead you should think, okay, maybe there's some good in what somebody's telling me. I'll try it. And then if I can't do it, I'll go back and say, listen, I can't do it. I tried, but I can't do that yet. Not that I'll never be able to do it, but I'm not strong enough yet to do that. But don't say, no, I can't do it. Forever and ever I can't do it. Otherwise you'll make yourself like a retarded child. You know, they grow up, up and up, but their brain doesn't. We don't want to be like that. So accept that we're not so advanced yet. Accept that. Don't feel that. It's not an embarrassment. That's what I'm trying to say. It's just a time-related thing. And next time when I come, I'll see a different part of you. Yeah? I'm looking forward to that. Okay, thank you. Anything else? All right. Thank you so much. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.